Delicious meat, nutritious. Crack into a good source of protein with tasty, healthy, Wonderful Pistachios. Wonderful Pistachios is a complete protein, providing all 9 essential amino acids. In fact, each 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios contains 6 grams of protein. Pistachios have got to be the tastiest nut. Pistachios are delicious, they pack a nutritional punch, and are oddly fun to eat. It's like a little dopamine drop every time you hear that shell crack open. Personally, I like them roasted and salted, but you can find your favorite shell or no shell variety at WonderfulPistachios.com. Whether you are running between meetings or dropping off the kids, Wonderful Pistachios are the snack that works as hard as you do. Check out WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more about this healthy, tasty snack. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics' True Age test? Well, I took it myself and the results are in. I found out my biological age, which directly predicts my risk for serious diseases. Here's why that matters. Research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. The good news is, nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hand. Yes, it's driven by things like your lifestyle, which means you have a lot of control over it. I was pleased to see my biological age was 6 years younger than my chronological age. That felt like a big win because I've definitely put a lot of time and attention on improving my lifestyle habits so they are more aligned with my health goals. The test also showed a few areas to work on and even pointed out low level of riboflavin or vitamin B2, which plays a huge role in energy metabolism. It's strange because I felt there was something inhibiting my energy, and now I have a simple theory I can test. The True Age test didn't just give me a number, it showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, no doctor visit or big needles, just a quick, painless finger prick. You send off that tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com and use my code MINDFUL to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code MINDFUL at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
And so if I look back on that moment in my life, I don't just forgive my dad. I'm grateful that my dad did exactly what he did. That I, you know, that I, like if I had it all to do over again, I would want him to do the exact same thing. That's a place of, that's not forgiveness, that's gratitude. And forgiveness is kind of like this concept that, like, you know, I'm right, you're wrong. I'm going to let it go this time, but don't you ever do it again. Versus gratitude is the place of, no, I can see how this served me exactly as it is.
Kayala, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
Hey, Les. Well, thanks so much for having me, brother. I really appreciate, you know, the time.
So you're the founder of Inspirion. Am I saying that right?
Yes. So sold my previous business in 2024 and went full time as, you know, founder and CEO of Inspirion. So it's been around for a couple of years. It's just that now this is like my primary focus and really what I want to spend the rest of my life doing.
Oh, nice. Well, that's what you say now.
We never know what the future holds. This is a fair point. I agree.
So you alluded to some of the things you guys are working on before we hit record, and it was very interesting. You mentioned you were moving to buy a ranch, so you had a ropes course. And I was like, what? Connect the dots for me, man. And it sounds like you have a very creative way of helping people, I guess, mentally, emotionally, and physically to provide some path of growth for them.
Yes. So, you know how, you know, high achievers, entrepreneurs, high achievers, like they know that they want to create something great. Like they know that they're up to something big in the world, but they often tend to come up against themselves in the process, right? Whether that's procrastination, self-sabotage, imposter syndrome, self-doubt, things like this. And then, you know, they've done the meditations, they've done the, you know, seminars. And for whatever reason, they're still experiencing some of these symptoms that stand between them and their goals, their dreams, their achievements, their aspirations. Well, what we do is, you know, through something that I call integrative neuroconditioning, we take our clients through a set of experiences that helps them rewrite their internal, you know, programming, their default programming, such that they overcome the procrastination, the self-sabotage, the imposter syndrome that's kept them from getting what they want. We have lots of success stories of you know, people who've grown their businesses 10x as a result. So that's what we do now. That's obviously not where I started.
Gotcha. Yeah, you're working on, I guess, rewiring people's brain to some extent, which there's a lot of ways to do. There's like a lot of tools out in the world now that people are using to reframe the way they think about things, reframe their relationship with themselves or others, and change how they could show up in the world. But you're using very different strategies, it sounds like. Can you talk a little bit about the, I guess, I don't know if I'd say adventurous side of this? You're using what sounds to be like a giant playground.
Yeah, well, that's one way to put it for sure. So let me back up first and kind of break down our general thesis, right? The way that we create our belief systems about ourselves or the world around us. So we know through, you know, cognitive psychology from 0 to about 7, 8 years old, a child's brain is operating at theta brainwave. So essentially that means that, you know, they have no firewall. Theta is the same brainwave as hypnosis. So they have no firewall. Everything gets in. The upside to this is that that's why we say that children are like a sponge. The downside to this is that they have no prefrontal cortex yet, so they have no ability to filter and rationalize the world. In other words, you know, when mom and dad split, they don't have the ability to rationalize and say, well, mom and dad didn't have great communication, and that's why they split up. No, what they experience is, dad's not around anymore. He must not love me. I must not be lovable. And so from 0 to about 7, 8 years old, we create, you know, there's different theories here, but and somewhere in the ballpark of 80 to 90% of what we believe about ourselves or the world around us was created before we had a rational mind. So when we back that up a bit, what we discover is that, you know, we have these highly charged emotional experiences, many of which happen in our early childhood. And from those emotional experiences, we create a belief about ourselves or the world around us. And what we do in our programs is we help people rewrite those beliefs using the exact same methodology. So some people will use repetition-based approach to changing their, you know, neurology. A repetition-based approach can be something like, you know, affirmations. It can be meditation, which obviously you guys have a beautiful podcast about. And these are things that are scientifically proven to work over time. And at the same time, when we look at the brain as an organ, it's an adaptation tool. So the more pressure it's under, the faster it adapts, the faster that neurology can change. So we take our clients through a series of experiences. So not lectures, not a motivational seminar, not note-taking experiences, but a series of experiences that can be in our online class. It can be games, small group exercises, various activities, wherein through the experience itself, one, they discover themselves, they learn about themselves, they learn about their current wiring, and secondly, they create more neuroplasticity, meaning the brain is more malleable to change. Because when we're talking about changing our results, ultimately what we're talking about is changing our actions. If we're talking about changing our actions, we're talking about changing our thinking. And if we're talking about changing our thinking, really what we're talking about, what we know in psychology, is 95% of our thinking is unconscious. So ultimately what we're talking about is changing our unconscious programming. So if we want to change our outcomes, we change our programming. And so ultimately, that's what we take people through, is a series of experiences, much like what created the programming in the first place. This time they get to substitute that programming with something that they choose versus something that was chosen for them in early childhood. They get to do it with their prefrontal cortex versus their amygdala, if that makes sense.
That's interesting. So the example you used just a moment ago, I mean, kind of sums up a lot for me, like my parents splitting up early and then realizing later that, you know, I developed a lot of strategies, how to show up in the world and help me get through it and cope, to account for the fact that I didn't understand that it was an issue between two adults. It wasn't about me. It had nothing to do with my worthiness, whatever. How in a like classroom setting or what seems like an adventure park setting or something, do you simulate something like that? Like, how do you create that so then someone could work through it in a different way now that they have access to a more developed frontal cortex and such?
Yes. So there's a few different ways that we do this. There's an introductory class we do called Genesis. That's a 3-day online class. The fact that it's online and 3 days, you know, it's going to have its set of limitations. And then we have advanced classes where we take this, we integrate some other modalities into the advanced classes. But let me kind of give you a high level overview. So to your example about mom left, you know, mom and dad split, and we create these beliefs about ourselves in regards to that. In the course of our 3-day class, we start, you know, taking people through a series of experiences. And as they're having these experiences, at the end of the exercise or the activity or the game or whatever it is we do, what we do is we kind of hold up a mirror. The facilitator will hold up a mirror for a while and start asking questions that are self-reflective. You know, what did you experience during the game? What belief system creates that experience for you? Because if the game created our experience, as an example, right? If the game created our experience, we would all experience the same thing. But the game doesn't create the experience, because if we're all experiencing different things, then we are creating our experience. And that's really just a mirror for life in general, right?
Projecting your insecurity or whatever through that game.
Yeah, we project our biases onto life, right? So life isn't happening to us so much as we are happening to life. And through those exercises, those experiences, they start to become aware of, wow, I remember this happened in childhood, or I remember going through this in high school or middle school, or I remember my parents talking about this, or when I grew up, my dad used to say this a lot. And so they start to discover where they've adopted these beliefs. And some of these beliefs can be heirlooms. You know, they're handed down from one generation to the next. One of the exercises, as an example, is we take them through a closed eye meditation wherein we call this exercise mom dad. And when they go through the exercise on mom dad, they're taken through a closed eye experience wherein they start to see the world through their mom's eyes and see the world through their dad's eyes. And we actually take them through a process wherein, like, they rewind back and see their dad as a child, and they see their mom as a child. And when they begin to see their life or their parents through their parents' eyes, you know, there's a sense of empathy that oftentimes we don't get as children growing up, you know. And they realize, like, oh, mom and dad, they were doing their very best too. But just like I have programs and belief systems that I've created over time that aren't necessarily true, they've created those same things too. And they just kind of, they were doing the best they could with those experiences. And so oftentimes one of the biggest, you know, feedbacks, comments that we'll get from people who complete that class is like, that exercise was an extremely powerful exercise wherein they didn't just get to a place of forgiveness for their parents, but oftentimes they get to a place of gratitude, which is a place beyond forgiveness, right?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That sounds like an incredible exercise. I mean, leading to not just forgiveness, I would assume, but like just compassion, you mm-hmm. know, being able to, what is it like for them? I remember personally with my dad, we went through a bunch of mayhem. And when I was trying to work through it, I found myself thinking similarly, I mean, not going through a formal exercise like that, but through the process, learning like the fact that the way that he was showing up in his relationship with me as, you know, later as an adult was really born out of what it was like for him growing up in his house mm-hmm. and understanding like, oh, like, for instance, he grew up in a house where nobody fought. Everybody, it was all peace. Nobody raised mm-hmm. their voice ever. So when we had like chaos in our household, he didn't know how to navigate that. And one thing that would show up is I would raise my voice out of, you know, just wanting to be heard or whatever. And because he grew up in a place where nobody raised their voice, he would like shut down from that and like disengage and retract away. So at a time in my life where I needed my father to run towards me, he would run away because that's all he knew how to do, because he didn't know how to, because he was affected by that. And then it would be like this cycle. I would get louder because I'd be unheard. He would run away because he can't deal with the loudness, essentially. And it would just, you know, it would spin out of control. But in seeing that, and you mentioned earlier, like holding up a mirror, I mean, having the awareness of what's going on is the first step. But in seeing that, not only allowed me to hold a space of compassion for him, but you're right, like to make it easier to forgive him, like not necessarily blame him or think like this is his fault. This is just him showing up in the world the only way he knows how to. And then I'm in response to that. And you're right, eventually being grateful for the lessons learned through that, because there's always two sides of the coin too. I remember growing up a lot thinking, or not growing up, but like as my kids were hitting like the age where I was when mayhem broke out in my household and it becoming really, really important for me to do things differently, I was lucky enough to be, to see or to find gratitude in those lessons, to be like, oh yeah, I could be upset over how my dad showed up for me, but I could equally be as grateful for learning how I want, because of that, how I want to show up for my son. And I would always approach my relationship with my kids with that context of like, what did I need? Or what do I at least think that I needed at the time? And it's such a powerful tool, which all starts with like shining a light on it, which is probably half the battle of a lot of these experiences, just getting people to understand why they experience it. Why are they experiencing that exercise the way that they are experiencing it?
Precisely. I mean, yeah, I mean, you nailed it. I don't really know that I have any much more to add to that, really.
Oh. Well, let me ask, like, what brought you to do this? Because before you, it sounds like you were doing something very different. The impression I get from like your online content was there's a lot of like online business strategy stuff, which is not, which is interesting. Not a topic we generally talk a lot about on this podcast, but I mean, something must have triggered you to switch gears, or maybe did you go through this process yourself and this was born out of some pain as you were, you know, realizing you were being affected by something that happened when you were in that, those first 7 years, like you alluded to earlier?
Yeah, I would say like many of us that are, you know, teachers or healers as a profession, it's our mess that becomes our message, right? And I'm sure you can relate from listening to what you share on your podcast. And so I'll rewind and tell this story. So remember I was saying that, you know, what we do is we currently work with like entrepreneurs, high achievers, to help them overcome the mental roadblocks that stand between them and their goals. And we guarantee results on that as well. And obviously I didn't start there, right? So let's rewind to 2010. I'd been in a wannabe entrepreneur for about 10 years. Total failure, you know, I mean, just, you know, catastrophic, embarrassing failures over and over again. And one day I'd come home from a barbecue. And at the time I lived with some roommates, and sitting on my bed was a stack of photographs. And I can vividly remember walking into the room and going like, what is that? So I walk up to my bed and I pick up this stack of photographs. And every photograph was ripped in half, and there was about a dozen of them in the stack. And as I'm going through the stack of photographs, at the bottom there was a note. And the note said, picture me out of your life. And this is how my girlfriend of 4.5 years broke up with me, which I think is a pretty savage way to break up with somebody. And I remember thinking in the moment like, okay, obviously she's upset. Eventually we'll talk. We'll figure this out, right? Like, I didn't see this coming, kind of a thing. Well, fast forward about 3 weeks later. At this point, I've moved out of the house with my roommates because I couldn't afford rent anymore. I'm back living with my mom. You know, I'm struggling to make, you know, a meager existence, you know, for myself. And she won't respond to a text message, a phone call, nothing. I can't get any response from her. And I start taking this inventory of my life. I'm pacing up and down the hallway in my mom's little, like, 1,000-square-foot apartment. And I can remember exactly where I'm standing. I can remember exactly what I was wearing. The moment that it hits me, and what hit me was, what if it's me? That was the question. What if it's me? You know? Because what I suddenly realized is in every area of my life where I was unhappy, unsatisfied, unfulfilled, out of alignment, not getting the results that I wanted, the only common denominator was me. I was the only thing that any of those things had in common. And while that was, you know, a painful pill to swallow, at the same time, it was the most freeing question I've ever asked. It was one of the biggest breakthroughs, because I realized in that same moment, well, if I can't, maybe I can't change everybody else, but I can definitely change me, right? And so that began my journey through the world of, you know, that's what introduced me to personal development. So I reached out to a buddy of mine who had been talking to me about this, you know, class, very similar to the 3-day class that we do online today. He'd been talking to me about this class for a while, and he's like, man, like all these go-getters I know, like all these really ambitious people that I know, I've like met several millionaires through this class and stuff, like you should really check it out. And I was like, well, you know, I kept making up excuses about why I couldn't go. So I reached out to him and I said, hey, man, this is what I'm going through right now. You know, Tiani and I aren't together. We split. I've kind of recently had this discovery. Would you recommend that I take this class? And he's like, man, you're in for one hell of a journey. And 2 weeks later, I was sitting in a classroom in person, experiencing something very similar to what we create at our Genesis class. And by the second day of that class, I just knew my whole life's going to be different after this. Like, there's just no way that I walk out of this room and my life is ever the same again. And it wasn't from something the facilitator said, or it wasn't from like some lecture or some notes that I took. It was from discoveries that I had about myself and why I was showing up in certain ways in my life. And from there, I did, you know, obviously much more, personal development work. Then I eventually got into like the science, like brain science. And I just got for the last 15 years or so, everything I could get my hands on this topic. This has probably been my number one obsession, in life. And at the same time, as I came out the other end of those experiences in 2011, I thought maybe I'll be a life coach. Like, I wanted to take this stuff that was so inspiring for me and, you know, powerful for me and potent for me, that I wanted to share it with the world. So I thought maybe I'll become a life coach. So I scrounged some money together, thousands of dollars that I didn't have, went through an 11-month program, come out the other end. I'm trying to get clients for my life coaching. I discover fairly quickly that nobody wants to be coached by a guy who's broke with a 500 credit score, living in his mom's spare bedroom, working in a coffee shop for minimum wage. And there's this. So I start looking into affiliate marketing online, which is something that I had done in the past, but I had never really taken it seriously. And so I start relearning affiliate marketing. There's a conference. I sell everything I have. I pick up extra hours at work. I go to this conference in San Diego. I remember, like, on my way there, I was planning on sleeping at the convention, the San Diego Convention Center. I was planning on sleeping there because I didn't have any money for a hotel room, just to get to this conference that was an internet marketing conference. And on the first day of that conference, the founder of the company comes out. There was a couple of speakers that opened up. The founder of the company comes out, and he delivers this beautiful, beautiful speech about, you know, how everything that he went through to build that company. And I remember looking around the room, there's about 1,800 people in the room. People are hanging on the edge of their seat. Towards the end of his talk, people are, there are tears in their eyes. And I realized he just did what I want to do. He inspired this whole room of 1,800 people. And if I go get results that people want to have, then, you know, they'll care what I have to say and the message that I have to share. And so there's this moment where it clicks for me that, like, the best way to share my message is for my life to become my message. And that's when I got serious about, like, creating an income, not necessarily so that it could fill my bank account, but that it could fill my soul in terms of becoming something that I could deliver my service of love to the world through. So for the last, that was in 2012, I went on to make my first $1 million as an affiliate marketer. I had the great opportunity, you know, to apply what I learned in these classes to an endeavor. So over the course of 3 years, I make my first $1 million. That turns into lots of people asking me to teach them what I'm doing, how I'm doing it, how am I running Facebook ads, how am I building an email list, all these different things. And so in 2016, it kind of organically turned into a coaching business. This is before everybody and their brother was a coach. And so we launched a coaching business. I scaled that from zero to $1 million a month in 4 months, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend to anybody. I mean, it was a very, very rapid growth, a lot of stress. And then over the next several years, we did about 140 plus million in that before I exited that company last year. But this, what I'm talking about with you here, this is something that we offered on the back end of that, all that coaching. This is something that we've offered ever since 2017. It always existed behind the scenes. You know, it was, hey, you know, if you want to make more money, here's my coaching program. I'll teach you affiliate marketing. But I knew that my clients' success had much less to do with them executing on the skills. Like, I know the skills work because the people that apply it get results. But it was more so reliant on, do they actually execute on the skill? Do they do the thing, right, that they're learning how to do? And that's about really clear. That's not so much about learning something as much as it is about unlearning a lot and clearing out the kind of mental head trash that stands between them and taking action. And so we had these classes on the back end. And then during the pandemic, I had an interesting conversation with my business partner. We were going through a lot of data about the business, and we discovered that every one of our students or clients that had made over $250,000 in a year, 100% of them had also done these mindset classes. And then I started looking at the reviews that people had and the results that people had in their life as a result of these classes. And I knew that I was in love with this stuff. I knew that it was important to me. I knew that it was really like my calling. But that's this moment during the pandemic when I realized, like, no, this is really what I want to do with the rest of my life. And so at that point, it became just a matter of time before I either exited or closed my previous company and spent the rest of my life doing this, which, as you said earlier, I mean, at least for now, we know that I am dedicated to this for the rest of my life. But who knows what the future holds, to be fair.
Gotcha. Oh, what a cool story. You throw some big numbers there. So you work with, like, high achievers now. What does that mean? I see a lot of people say that. What makes somebody think, I'm a high achiever, this program is for me? Or what does it mean on your end when you're trying to market to that?
Well, I think for the most part, high achievers kind of self-identify. Like, they hear the word high achievers and they think, like, that's me. I am that person. Versus, you know, oftentimes people, I know for myself, I wouldn't have necessarily years ago called myself a high achiever. But the folks that have big dreams, big ambitions, big goals in life, especially entrepreneurs, because entrepreneurs can see the results of our work right away because they're in a performance-based role. So if their performance changes, they reap the rewards immediately, right?
What's an example of that? Like, let's say someone is, when I think of an entrepreneur, I think of somebody that's a business owner of some sort that is, maybe like self-motivated or self-starter, someone that's like trying to create something and deploy it to some level of monetary success or whatever. So what's an example of someone that is in that realm, like going through like a Genesis program and how that relates to them being more successful in the direction of this high achieving as they identify it?
Yeah. So an example that comes to mind as you were asking is a guy named Cole Van D in our community. We recently got a testimonial from him. So I met Cole initially in 2018, and we were doing, like, again, back then we were doing these classes like largely behind the scenes. I met Cole initially in 2018. At the time, he was a copywriter. So for those who might not know, copywriters are basically people who write words that generate sales, right? So advertisements you see, marketing emails you see, these are written by people who are professional writers. So he was a copywriter. And he was working a full-time job at a car dealership because no matter how much he worked at his copy, and he was one of the best copywriters whose stuff I had ever read. And I have a background in copywriting as an online advertiser, you know, so I know good stuff when I see good stuff. So I see this and I'm like, man, this guy's super talented. And at the same time, like, he's not getting the results that his talent warrants, right? So we hire him to do some work for us. He's working a full-time job on the side to keep things, to stay afloat financially. And over the course of 2018 into 2019, for over a year, I'm talking to him about these classes that we do. I'm letting him know, like, you should come check these out. Like, I really think that this will be a big breakthrough for you. Like, I can tell in hanging out with you that, like, the only thing keeping you from, you know, being one of the most successful copywriters I've ever met is the mental head trash that you're holding on to, the stories that you keep telling yourself about who you are and what the world is and all these sorts of things. And for him, he was like, nah, man, I've done a lot of personal development. You know, I've read these books, you know, I've been to like the Tony Robbins events and these sorts of things. And so his thing was initially, well, I've done a lot of work on myself already. I'm not sure that this is going to be different. Well, come 2019, he comes into one of our Genesis classes, and, you know, goes through the whole experience. At the end of the experience, he was like, man, I'm so grateful that you wouldn't, you know, that you were relentless about this, because this is very different than anything else I experienced. He eventually, over the course of 2019, 2020, goes through our advanced classes. By 2021, I believe, he's now running, he's full time in his business. He's doing about $500,000 a year as a copywriter, which would put him in the top 1% of copywriters. And in 2024, when we just recently got his testimonial, he's like, this year I've added, you know, $1.1 million to my bank account that I am sure I wouldn't have had I not done these classes. So in talking with Cole, you know, what I've discovered in our conversations is the majority of what held him back was not a lack of skill set, right? It's that he grew up in an environment where he was basically told that he would never amount to much, never really be anything. You know, he grew up in what, you know, we would probably refer to as the ghetto, where at one point in his life, like, he really thought that he might not make it to his mid-20s. So for him to be alive in his mid-20s was a win, you know. You went to a school where, you know, the education wasn't great. So he was under the belief system that, like, well, I'm not very well educated, so I probably can't really, you know, create much. So even though he has big goals, big dreams, big ambitions, his expectations for himself and the world did not match those ambitions. The story that he had written about himself and his place in the world didn't match his ambitions. And so, you know, what we find over and over again in our classes is that, like, we will not create a result for ourselves that is in contradiction with our own self-narrative, with a story that we've made up about ourselves. A great example of this is, you know, lottery winners. If you do the research on lottery winners, the vast majority of lottery winners, something like 90%+, not only lose all the money and return to their initial financial state, most of them interviewed wish that they did not win the lottery.
That's crazy. Right?
Because having $1 million doesn't make you a millionaire. Right? Like, I think it was Jim Rohn who said, if you come into $1 million, you better become a millionaire quick. Oh, millionaire is like, is, you know, it's a state of mind. You know, it's a level of character that is forged over time. And so whenever we get results that don't fit in the, let's call it the mental container of our mind, we will sabotage those results to match our own story. And so that's why through our classes, you know, our program is much more around helping people write a new story about themselves, you know, and a story that matches the goals, dreams, and ambitions that they have for their life. In short, we identify ourselves as a leadership training company. And when people come out the other end, they understand why it's a leadership training company. And this is how we define leadership. Everyone in life, everyone has a calling. Leaders are the ones with the courage to answer. So they're the ones who are willing to rise up and say, like, there's something bigger for me in life and I want to go get it. But everyone has it. And, you know, our core belief is that every human being has something remarkable to offer the world. Leadership is the key to unlocking it. And so when we're talking about leadership, we're much less talking about leadership in leading other people, but in leadership of ourselves, that, you know, we write the narrative of our internal dialogue that we create. Like, the man that I am today is not the man that I was born. My mom would tell you that, like, I mean, she's been at some of my events, and she'll talk to, she'll be talking to people, and she's like, that's not the boy that I raised. He made himself this way, you know, because she can see that the how I show up in life today is not how I was raised to show up in life today, that I recreated from the inside out who that person is. And for us, that's the process of leadership, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. We're very malleable, and we have a lot of say in, you know, what dictates the changes and the adaptations, not just in our, you know, physical body, but obviously in our brain, our mind. Yeah, so it's interesting, like Cole's scenarios, he was essentially subconsciously or unconsciously like setting the bar low. So he was still experiencing wins, even though it was like all within a different context. So that's...
Well, he'll tell you that, like, you know, a lot of his belief system was like, people can't be trusted. Everyone takes advantage of me. You know, this is coming from his background, how he grew up. And so an interesting thing about the way that our mind and brain works. So if you don't mind, I'll dig into a little bit of like the brain science around this.
Oh, cook away, so
the amygdala will tag memories as good or bad. This is called valency. So then when the amygdala tags a memory as good or bad, it is stored in the hippocampus with valency. And so it's in the subcortical center of the brain. And then as we go forth in life, because our brain is a survival mechanism and an adaptation tool, what we can observe is that as we experience things in life, our brain starts using these memories as references. So anything that comes up that triggers an old memory, I mean, this is what it means to be triggered. This is what it means to have, like, why does something push my buttons? Well, what is a button? A button is just an old, unresolved memory that's polarized. And so, you know, we experience these things in the present, but we reference, because our brain is wired for shortcuts to help us navigate the world, it references old memories. And as soon as something comes up that references one of these quote unquote negative memories and that we haven't resolved, we bring all of that baggage right into the present. So rarely are we even truly present. You know, that's what I love about what you're doing with your mindfulness podcast and all of the meditations that you create, is you create the opportunity for somebody to practice presence, like being present. Because we're so rarely actually present. So we bring that baggage from our past into the present moment. We judge this moment based on the past, which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy wherein we respond to this moment the same way that we responded to it in the past, and we create that experience over and over and over again, helping us be right about our story. In Cole's case, people can't be trusted. People always take advantage of me. It helps us be right about our story, but wrong about our goals, dreams, and ambitions oftentimes. One is our identity, our existing identity, and one is an identity that we would love to have, right? And so when he's caught up in that narrative, everything that comes, like as these experiences come up for him, he's unable to approach those experiences from a fresh perspective. And so he creates over and over again in his life, and he'll tell you this, isn't like me telling you this, he'll tell you this, he creates over and over again in his life new events, new experiences that match the old experiences of the past. And at that point, he is caught in a revolution rather than an evolution, right? His destiny is dictated by his history versus being dictated by his present choices and actions. Am I making sense to you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it resonates a lot. Like the brain kind of mapping out these things from the past that helped you, you know, get through whatever the thing was that was happening. And then when something triggers you now, you are like right back there. Mm-hmm. Like you're bringing all that stuff that originally generated that map in your brain to this moment, and then you're living out of it. I mean, I did this fucking yesterday, man. This is, we're recording the day after Father's Day, and we had people over, and I have this thing that I do, and I've worked through a lot of my issues, but, you know, we always have more, whatever. And I have this thing where when somebody says something that I don't find true or accurate in a conversation, it's like I can't go on and move past that without ironing out that. And it's like there's something in me that wants to be right and like get that person to see a different way. And it creates a shitty conversation. Like this desire for me to be right instead of be like quiet and calm or kind or whatever fucking ruins it for everybody. And, you know, and like, and it's always, it's never with like, well, maybe it is sometimes, but it's usually with like the people I care about most. Like these are with like family members. Like these are the people I care about. And I wind up getting in these arguments that my wife will say are pretty one-sided because I don't give people room to speak, but I don't know where that comes from. Like maybe I'm just still trying to earn validation or something as a kid. And that's like just showing up as you know, almost 48-year-old man still when it's not necessary. Like it doesn't really matter even if the person that I'm talking to is wrong and I'm right. And it continues to be that way. Like, you know, 100 years from now, it's all new people anyway. Like I might as well enjoy the relationships I have. Like they don't have to be these chaotic, you know, debates. And part of it is like, I have the devil's advocate gene or something. And where I'm always playing that side. I don't know if it's like, I want people to see that there's more than one way to look at something.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is because I want to help them because I do think it's helpful because we don't know. We really don't know when we're blinded by, you know, that, you know, we're affected by information that comes in and you could be seeing a sliver of things and it might be a fact, but not the truth. It might not be the whole picture and that there's other ways, there's other components. And like, you know, it comes up in political a lot because people always think that people on a different political spectrum, they think they know why those people do things. But it's like, yeah, you're wrong. And just like they're wrong when they think that you believe what you do because you do. Like people think they know why other people do things. And I like to point out that it might not be what you think. And I don't know, like when I was a kid, when my parents were splitting up, there was a long time there where there were these real like weird relationships between my two sisters, my mother, and my father. And I was always in the middle. So like my sisters and my mother would have stories about my dad. And then I would be like the one defending him. Like, no, you. And then my dad would say, well, your mom this and your sister's this. And then I'd be defending them. So I was like in the middle. And my guess as I get older and think about this stuff is that's probably where it comes from. The fact that I was like the buffer in the middle, always defending the other to the other side of the family. And maybe it's showing up some way that it's just like at this age, it's like maladaptive. The fact that as a grown man, I'm still like raising my voice, not cutting people off in the middle of a conversation, shit like that, which I don't like that side of me. But in the moment when I'm like triggered, it happens so fast, like I don't even notice it's happening. And then I'm in it. And like whatever chemical makeup I'm experiencing there, I don't know how to just turn off. And I know tons of mindfulness-based strategies and breath practices and different ways to think about things and, you know, years of meditation. But in the moment where all your old shit is being expressed in this moment, you know, it's not the easiest thing. You know, and I'll even see like my wife leave the room and you'd think I would take that as a symbol that like I should go out and get some fresh air. Like I should, you know, I should be able to take the funny glance from across the room from my daughter or the fact that she's tuning out and like, oh, here dad goes again. For some reason, that's not registering to me in the moment as a signal to like calm down.
Yeah. I mean, when we are polarized in that moment of needing to be right, I mean, we are, the amygdala is activated and we are in a survival mode, right? And so if we're polarized about something that challenges our values or triggers old unresolved challenges, we're going to perceive that as a predator, you know, and from the amygdala standpoint. And at that point, like, you don't want to become the prey.
Right.
And so even though it rationally doesn't make sense, in a survival tribal sense, it makes sense that you're fighting for your life in those moments. And that's why you cannot let it go, because it feels like your survival is based on this. Can I respond to some of this really quick, if you don't mind?
Oh, yeah. Hope so.
So there's a few different things that you bring up, and I think that this is beautiful. Like, this is where the conversation really starts to land, man. And I love it. One of our deepest needs is the need to be right, right? Because as a tribal species, if you look at like at the human brain from an evolutionary standpoint, we are wired to be tribal, meaning we have to fit into a group somewhere. Have you ever watched the show Alone?
Oh, I love that show.
Oh, my, yeah, okay, me too. My girl,
that's
and I
one of the few shows I actually watch. I watch very little TV.
I normally will like watch documentaries or something if I'm going to watch something, but my girl and I were on vacation once in Hawaii a few years ago, and we happened to turn on Alone, and then we got addicted while we were on vacation, right? But the reason I bring it up is because, as you'll know then, they take people who are survival experts, right, trained in survivalism. They put them out in the wilderness all by themselves with nothing other than, you know, a few resources, a few tools, and a camera. And they begin documenting their experience. And whoever lasts the longest wins the quote unquote contest here in the show. And I'm just kind of explaining this for your guests. But notice, Les, that like nobody thrives, right? It's always who's going to die last, right? Because who's going to starve last? Nobody, like, you know, creates a village and goes on to build an empire. Like, nobody is thriving in that environment because we are not designed to be alone. And so our brain, as part of being part of a tribe from a very early, you know, from some of our earliest memories will be memories around being told, you know, don't do that. Nope, not that. No, you're wrong. And so we're indoctrinated from a very early age to be right as a way to fit into a tribe. And so it becomes a survival mechanism. Now, imagine then that you write these stories from 0 to 7 or 8 years old about who you are in the world, how you fit into the world. Those stories are completely irrational, completely illogical. They're based purely on emotion and, you know, the amygdala driving the narrative. And then you develop these stories, and for the rest of your life, you want to be right about those stories. That means then that a 7 or 8 year old is in the driver's seat of your life. And I hope that scares some people just a little bit, you know? And so what you're expressing, though, is perfectly natural. Here's what's interesting about the trigger is when we, a simple question might be, well, what is right? What does it mean to be right? So from the perspective of physics, we can observe that in any closed system, there is equanimity or equilibrium or homeostasis. So in other words, equanimity is like the language of the universe, in that for everything, there's a balance. Here, I'll give you an example. I was reading recently that, you know, the Black Plague of the 14th century, right? Bubonic plague. It's gone by many different names. Estimated to have killed tens of millions of people. Now, the people alive at the time, they said that, you know, it was a curse from the gods, that, you know, humans were being punished for their sins, these sorts of things. Now, fast forward to the 80s and 90s. Our generation, Les. And what most people don't know is that millions of people were immune to the HIV virus because of a genetic mutation passed down from their ancestors who survived the bubonic plague. So something that took millions of lives saved millions of lives centuries later. So was it good or was it bad? The reality is it was both. If we believe that the universe is made up of energy and that energy can't be created or destroyed, there's a law of conservation. Well, the smallest form of energy, you know, we might say is an atom. An atom is comprised of a electron, a neutron, and a proton. So it has both a positive charge and a negative charge in equal proportion. If it's not in equal proportion, it's no longer an atom, it's become an ion. If that is the thing, if that is what makes up the fabric of the universe, how can anything exist that is not both? Positive and negative. And so when we have this need to be right, what we're expressing is a polarized perspective. What we're expressing is a polarized perspective about the world that contradicts what we can observe about the universe from the standpoint of physics, which is that for every benefit, there's a drawback. For every drawback, a benefit. For every up, there's a down. For every left, there's a right. Right. And in any closed system, there is going to be a balance. So when we work with our clients at our advanced classes, this is what, now we're getting into like some of the advanced material. When we work with our clients at advanced classes, we know that like they can kind of only go as far forward in their life as their unresolved pains, frustrations, anguishes, traumas will allow them to go based on the narrative that they've created about their life story up until that point. So one of the things that we do is we equip them with a set of tools that allows them to depolarize, or in other words, bring balance to the mind when they trigger old memories or old unresolved traumas. So in other words, they start looking for, well, I experienced this as a child. You know, as an example, when, you know, my parents divorced when I was 13 years old and my dad wasn't around for a couple of years. That was one of the memories that came up for me. And using the process that we share in our advanced class, I'm able to go back and look and see all of the upsides to that, all of the benefits to that. Like there was benefits to my dad not being around. There, you know, and to give you the short version of the story, it helped me create the career that I have today. So I wouldn't be who I am today if my dad had stayed. And so if I look back on that moment in my life, I don't just forgive my dad. I'm grateful that my dad did exactly what he did, that I, you know, that I, like if I had it all to do over again, I would want him to do the exact same thing. That's a place of, that's not forgiveness. That's gratitude. Right? Forgiveness is kind of like this concept that like, you know, I'm right. You're wrong. I'm going to let it go this time, but don't you ever do it again. Versus gratitude is the place of, no, I can see how this serves me exactly as it is. I can see the divine wisdom of the universe through the apparent chaos of life. And I can, and if I had it all to do over again, I would change nothing. And at that point, like that's what we define in our curriculum as like a master of life, is that we're not projecting our biases on life, but that we are seeing how life is serving us. We're like, and oftentimes when it feels really in all, every time that it feels like the road is falling out from beneath us, it's actually rising up to meet us and take us on our mission. It's just very difficult for us as humans to experience that beauty, that divinity, that, you know, splendor of life, because we project onto life our biases. We judge things as good or bad or right or wrong. And then we resist what life is. You know, I've said before that all human suffering, all suffering, is found in the gap between what life is and what we think that life ought to be, should be, supposed to be, needs to be, has to be. And that gap, right, is where we experience all of our pain and anguish and frustrations and resentments and baggage that we carry throughout our life. And it's not wrong. It's just that our brains are, because of the way that we learn, we learn through polarization. We learn through contrast. That's how we start to define the, like, we know what hot is because we know what cold is. We know what up is because we know what down is. We know what left is because we know what right is. So on and so forth. That's how we learn. So the brain is a tool to navigate the world. But at the highest level, when we step outside of it and look at it from a you know, physics perspective or a quantum physics perspective, we can observe that the universe is really both. That it's, that all things, that every benefit has a drawback, every drawback a benefit, every price has a payoff, every, you know, curse has a blessing. And so we learn about our world through our brain, which uses contrast, but wisdom is to see that that contrast is an illusion. And then we move from revolution to evolution. I said a lot of things there. I hope some of it made sense.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it makes me, a moment ago, I was just thinking about, like, in the scenario that I just painted about, you know, getting triggered by and then wanting to be right and thinking back where that might come from and being that buffer between the family. I was thinking, like,
can I add a thought to that really quick, Les?
Yeah, sure.
So notice how you were the buffer in the family, because in a closed system, there's always a balance. So if your mom and your sisters team up against your dad, you play the opposite side. You become the balance in that dynamic and take the side of your dad. If your dad badmouths your sisters or your mom, you take the balance on the other side. And so you're playing that role to balance out the family dynamic. And in any family, we'll see that members of the family will start playing out roles to balance the family dynamic.
Right, but I'm also thinking, what did it mean to not be right? It meant, like, because I, like, the family is essentially was being pulled apart or torn apart or breaking apart. So it's like, beautiful. If I was wrong, the family was going to tear apart. Like, I needed to be right and convince the others about a different way to see the other side of the triangle. You know, it was like a moving triangle almost. That's what needed to be done to keep it together, as if, like, I was the one, as a, you know, adolescent trying to hold the family together. Like, it was my fucking job as a kid, which it wasn't. So, like, being right and convincing somebody that I was right was, I guess, deeply important to the amygdala. You know, that was survival of the family in my subconscious mind.
That's such a beautiful discovery that it brings tears to my eyes. I don't know if your listener, obviously your listeners won't be able to hear those tears in my eyes. And it's such a beautiful discovery because you were fighting for your existence. The family not being together as a child is a life-threatening experience. So you were fighting for your survival. And then you carry that role forward in your life. And when something else triggers you, it's a survival opportunity. I've got to be right or die. Hmm. Beautiful. Yeah.
Boy, I did not see this conversation going this way, Kayla.
Neither of us could.
Interesting. It's very timely for me, you know. Yeah, I really appreciate some of your perspectives. Can you touch on, because it sounds like you have a good amount of studying of the how the brain works in regards to this. You mentioned kind of quickly the relationship between the amygdala and the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. So the amygdala is like I'm sure it has other things, but it's like a stress center of some sort. Like, what's the relationship of those two parts? What's the role that the hippocampus plays? I haven't learned much about the different parts of the brain.
So the amygdala would be what we consider like the oldest portion of the brain or the animal portion of the brain. So the amygdala's job is purely survival. It's the first survival mechanism of the brain. And so before, as a species, like from before we have language, which is the limbic brain,
before we have a prefrontal cortex, which is our genius center. It's what makes us, you know, separate from every other species on Earth. The amygdala is what keeps us alive. And so it has a, if you think about it from our survival, for survival perspective, the amygdala's job is to identify prey, escape predator. Okay. It is automatically biased because if you hear a rustle in the bushes, it is safer to assume that that rustle was a predator and run and miss out on a meal. Because if you assume that that rustle in the bushes is prey and it ends up being a predator, you become the meal.
Right.
Does it make sense?
Sure.
So it's biased for whatever is best for survival. So the amygdala, that subcortical portion of the brain, that's what we're operating from when we're like, you know, zero to, I mean, our prefrontal cortex starts to come online. You know, limbic brain starts to come online about 7, 8 years old. Prefrontal cortex really starts coming online when we're like 12, 13 years old. It can vary from person to person a little bit, but that's roughly, you know, the science of it. So the amygdala's job is just a survival mechanism. And all it's doing is it's, as you're a child navigating the world, it's just tagging experiences as good, bad, prey, predator, prey, predator. Get more of that, escape this at all costs. The hippocampus acts as like a storage mechanism in this example. It's acting as a storage mechanism to hold all of those memories so that when the amygdala tags something happening in the present, even as an adult, when it tags something, when it's referencing the past and it's tagging a present experience as similar to the past, it pulls up. It's like having a file cabinet in your mind, right? And so something comes up and we experience an emotion. The brain is looking back. The amygdala is looking. It's sorting through the file cabinet. It finds, you know, the file labeled political drama, right? And, you know, voted blue or whatever it is. And it pulls out that file, it pulls it out, it opens it up, and it starts reading, essentially, what that means for our survival, what that means for, you know, it becomes a reference mechanism. Again, not based rationally or logically, but a reference mechanism of an old set of emotions, an old set of polarizations that we now bring to the present, and then by definition, we start to create a future that matches our past. So the amygdala assigns value or valency to memories. The hippocampus stores those memories.
Okay.
And then because our brain needs to process lots of information in a very short period of time, it uses those as shortcuts as we experience, as we go forward into the world.
Gotcha.
Now, when we want to... Here's an example I'll share with you, quick story. I was recently asked to speak at an online event. This one was about marketing and sales. It was about 20-something people on. These are all network marketing leaders. They're wanting to learn online marketing skills and whatnot. And so I'm on for about 90 minutes or so. I'm training this group. They're asking questions. I'm breaking down advertising for them and online marketing stuff for them. And towards the end, a woman asks a question. I'm going through the process of answering her question. Another woman kind of unmutes, speaks up and says, hey, listen, I know that we're all here to hear what Kiala has to say, but, you know, I disagree. I think you should do this, this, and this, and this. You know, it's cool. I was like, well, I mean, there's her opinion too, you know. I kind of just left it at that. And when the event was over, the host reaches out to me and she says, hey, thanks so much. That was amazing. That was super valuable for my organization. I really appreciate you taking the time. I hope that, you know, you weren't upset when XYZ person like unmuted themselves and spoke up. I hope that didn't bother you or anything. And I was like, no, we're good. And after I answered that text message, I sat with it for a moment and I asked myself, like, if they asked me to come speak again, would I go speak again? No. Right. And so I was like, okay, well, what's going on? What am I experiencing right now? And I could feel this kind of like, even when she spoke up, I could feel like there was something happening in my body, right? There was a charge that was coming up for me. So That's the amygdala, that emotion, that untamed, hard to explain, hard to put words to feeling. That's the amygdala. And so I know that I'm in the subcortical center of the brain. I'm in the survival mechanism of the brain. So I ask myself immediately, we call this name it to tame it. So I ask myself, okay, well, what am I experiencing right now? What's the emotion that I'm experiencing right now? I want to put words to it. This brings the limbic brain online. And so eventually what I realized is like, oh, I'm experiencing embarrassment. I was embarrassed because I was presented as this authority in front of this room. I'm doing my best to speak and answer all these questions, and I'm really giving it my best, and I don't presume to know everybody's answer to every question, of course. But when this woman speaks up and she contradicts me, I feel embarrassed in front of this room of people. So it's like, oh, that's what I'm experiencing, embarrassment. So now I want to bring the prefrontal cortex online. I want to, because I know that this is some old trigger coming up for me, right? So I ask myself, okay, well, what's my earliest memory of being embarrassed? And what comes to mind immediately is this time I was about 6 or 7 years old. I was playing in the backyard with my neighbor. She was a couple years older than me. We were playing in the backyard, right in front of her house, and I soiled myself. I wet myself. I was playing with her, and I was so into what we were doing that I knew that I had to go to the bathroom, but I didn't want to go. And eventually, I just wet myself, right? And I'm old enough to know not to do that. So she immediately starts laughing. You know, she starts making fun of me. She's pointing and laughing. I run back home. And the way that we lived is like it was 4 houses on a property and all of their backyards were connected. There was no fences in between. So I go running back home. I run through the back door into my house. My mom's standing there in the kitchen. She immediately looks at me. She's like, what are you doing? What happened? Why are you? Go to the bathroom. You know, what's wrong? So she starts scolding me. And I, you know, obviously go to the bathroom. I get cleaned up. I change. And I can remember feeling so much like shame in that experience. And then so I ask myself this next question. Okay, well, what were the benefits of that experience? Well, and this is just a few. Number one, I had to learn. One, I was learning about my physiology. I mean, I learned about like the limitations of my own body. Clearly, I cannot hold my bladder for forever.
It's a good lesson.
Right? We got to learn it sometime when we all did at some point, right? So I had to learn that. I had to learn resiliency because I still wanted to go out and play with my neighbor. I still wanted to be friends with her. I still wanted to go have a good time. So even though she made fun of me, I had to go face my own embarrassment and overcome the fears and judgments around that. When I came through the back door, my mom starts scolding me, and she's escalated now. I started talking to my mom. I was like, hey, mom, I'm sorry. You know, I was playing with Soraya. Soraya's the neighbor. I was playing with Soraya and da-da-da. And I start talking my mom down. And so I'm learning communication skills to navigate even my mom's emotions. And today, you know, part of my profession is a marketer. I communicate for a living. So that experience helped me master the craft that has paid my bills, you know, for the last decade or so. And so once I realize all that and I'm checking in on it, I'm like, man, if I had it all to do over again, would I prefer not to have soiled myself? No, I can see how that benefited me. And then I ask myself, okay, so if this audience, if this room, if this group asked me to speak again, would I go speak in front of that room again? I said, yes. I have no charge now about that girl speaking up to me, you know, in the room. She gave me a gift because she gave me the opportunity to love a part of myself that I was disowning in my past, and to, you know, gain new wisdom that serves me going forward in my future. So why would I want to escape that experience again? I can see how it served me. So I, in other words, I am decoding and seeing the hidden blessing in the apparent chaos of life. And that's life mastery, by our definition at least.
Kayla, what a great story. What a great perspective and mindset. I mean, that's such a great example of over time learning how to use your mind as a tool to serve you and ultimately, you know, the world better. That is wisdom. What a great explanation, like from start to finish of the experience to wisdom.
What we can observe is that, you know, anything that we resent we repeat. Anything that we judge, we attract, become, or create. And so we tend to repeat the same lessons in life over and over and over again until we can endow ourselves with the wisdom that the lesson was intended to serve us. And then we get to, instead of revolve, evolve.
I'm glad you didn't have to learn that lesson over and over and you don't still wet yourself.
I'm really glad for that too, Les. I appreciate I appreciate that. Yeah. And I, you know, I love being on this podcast with you. I like where the direction that it's taken. And I'm getting messages from my own physiology right now that caused me to not want to repeat the lessons of the past.
Okay. Do you have just a few more minutes?
Of course.
Yeah, okay.
Of course.
So there's, because I do want to ask you little, you know, switch gears a little bit. But before we hit record, you were talking about getting a ranch in Texas so that you can have like a proper ropes course for your some of the in-person events. Mm-hmm. And you were like high ropes, low ropes. And I was like, what? So what do you have planned there? And how do you use ropes course to help people integrate these evolutions?
Mm. Yeah, so as I was sharing earlier, right, like the way that we create the beliefs that tend to run our life is we have a highly charged emotional experience. As our way of coping with that experience, we create a belief about ourselves or the world around us or both. And that becomes a tool that we use to navigate life going forth from there. Just one of the challenges is that we do that from 0 to 7, 0 to 8 years old. The majority of that is already done for us before we can create beliefs that serve us. Before we can create beliefs that help us thrive, we're creating a belief system that helps us merely survive. Okay. So when we're talking about creating a new outcome, new results in our life, what we're talking about is changing our behaviors. If we're talking about changing our behaviors, we're talking about changing our thinking. If we're talking about changing our thinking, we're automatically talking about changing our unconscious mind, our unconscious belief system, because that's where 95% of our thinking takes place, is unconsciously. So the same process. Now, when we go through those experiences as a child, it doesn't take us weeks, months, or years to create that belief. It takes a moment. It happens almost instantaneously. And so what we do at our advanced classes is part of the tools that we use is that we take people through another set of highly charged emotional experiences. And now people might hear that and think, like, I'm going to be laying in a puddle of my own tears. No, it's not necessarily that. Although do some people shed tears at the class? Of course, right? Usually tears of inspiration, not desperation. But we take people through a series of emotional experiences wherein they have the opportunity now to create a new belief, to install a new belief about themselves or the world around them that they choose. So a belief by design versus by default. And so when we're talking about high ropes courses or low ropes courses, high ropes courses is an example. Like one exercise is that people will jump off of a 30-foot telephone pole to catch a trapeze. Now, you're tied in. Your safety – there's lots of – like, you know, our team is highly professional. They're trained for this. You know, there is – you are in a professional high ropes course, so there is ropes there to keep you safe. And, though, here's the thing. Even though you're tied in, even though, you know, every safety precaution has been taken, your brain does not perceive that when you're standing on top of a 30-foot pole, right? For your brain, this is a survival opportunity. And because our brain is an adaptation tool, the higher the stakes, the faster it adapts. So as when you're jumping off of that pole, if you're leaning off an edge, we have an exercise we call the edge. You know, you're 50, 60 feet up in the air, leaning off the edge of something. We have an exercise we call the high V's, where you're up in the air with a partner on ropes. There a ropes set that's about, there's a set of wires, cables that are 30, 40 feet in the air, and you're doing a partner exercise with this person. What's happening is the stakes are very high. the brain is having to adapt very quickly, and you're creating new neural pathways, right? Because just becoming aware of our old belief systems isn't enough. It creates neuroplasticity. It creates the what is called a gamma burst in the brain. So the brain has this, you know, momentary electrical charge, usually 30 to 100 hertz. It's measurable, where distant portions of the brain connect, and we go, oh, like, I never saw it that way. Oh, I'm just realizing this for the first time. Oh, I can see how that's been playing out in my life. These are aha moments. The science term for that would be a gamma burst. And while that opens the door for change in our mind, it doesn't create change by itself, right? What we're talking about when we're talking about change is changing the neural pathways of the brain, or remyelination of the brain. So by taking people through these high-stakes experiences, they are adapting the brain and remyelinating the brain and creating new neural pathways that overwrite the old neural pathways, and they're doing it at a much faster pace, at a much greater rate, with a much greater odds of success versus something like saying affirmations in the mirror every morning, you know? Because at the end of the day, like, affirmations are great, you know, I mean, and I've used them throughout. I still use them today. It's a part of my regular daily practice in the morning, is going through a set of affirmations. But nothing is as affirming as getting the result that I keep saying that I want. That's 1,000 times more affirming than telling myself that I am this person, is actually being that person and showing up that person and having the results of that person. That's 1,000 times more affirming than ranting in the mirror, if you know what I mean, right? So we are raising the stakes, adapting the brain, and creating new belief systems that serve them in going where they want to go at a much faster, more accelerated rate is essentially the short.
That sounds both very interesting and terrifying. I know I have a lot of fears around height related things, and that'd probably be really good for me. I fell out of a tree when I was 8. That might have something to do with it. I never even thought of that connection. That getting some epiphanies on this call here. I wonder if that's why I'm afraid of heights. Falling out of a tree when I was little. Maybe.
Likely tagged as negative in your, you know, and stored in your hippocampus.
and you mentioned, so you're in the process of creating one of these. So right now you do these, you rent ropes courses, I think you mentioned, and you run these programs, and soon you'll have your own place to do it. Is that what you were
getting? Yes. Okay. So historically we've rented other people's ranches, we want to bring people into a closed environment for the advanced classes, you know, so like you're waking up in the environment, you're going to bed in the environment. So there's this constant environment of self-reflection and self-realization, self-actualization. You're like in that
submersive, you know, 24/7 style thing.
Exactly.
Awesome.
But there's very few ranches in America that that have the facilities that we need. So it's, rather than renting them, which means that I obviously have to pass that expense on to our customers. A couple of years ago, we bought a 300-acre ranch in East Texas, and we're currently building that out, which will obviously help us save a lot of money in fulfilling these programs for our customers. But that's also savings that we can pass on to our customers so that more people can have the experience.
When do you see that being up and running?
Well, we are recording this episode in June, and the first class will be happening on our ranch. Now, this is going to be – we won't have the full class from end to end, but we're having what we call a hybrid class. The first one is happening in August. So they'll do their entire high ropes and low ropes experience on our ranch.
Okay. And if people want to learn more, where do they go to learn all this stuff you do, man?
So probably the best place to go if you wanted to see – you know, results in action. I would suggest if you're somebody who's a high achiever, an entrepreneur, and you want to break through procrastination, hesitation, frustration, self-sabotage, imposter syndrome, and these sorts of things, I would suggest going to thepowercode.com. There's a self-assessment that we give away there. When you download the self-assessment, I explain how it works on the page. Download the self-assessment. On the next page, there's a 2-hour masterclass that I take people through where they can learn much more about how to utilize what I call the power code. Then, you know, you can find me on Instagram, YouTube, and, you know, Inspirion.com.
Inspirion.com. Kayla, I got to say, I really enjoyed talking to you today, man. This has been a fun conversation. And you know, I appreciate some of the vulnerability that you offered, and this is really nice. It's great to connect with you.
The feeling is very mutual, and I appreciate the vulnerability that you offered too.
And for the listeners, always thanks. Always grateful for your listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And Kayla, I hope our paths cross again sometime.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
All right. Have a good day, everybody.